You know why people connect with my book so well? For some reason, God put me in almost every f***ed up situation on the planet Earth. So when I talk to people, it's not sugarcoated, because I'm not saying it from I was 175 pounds my whole life. I don't say much to those people. Maybe you're a piece of shit. Maybe you want to be nobody. Maybe you're happy exactly where you are in life, because obviously you are. Maybe you don't have the determination to be somebody better than who you are. And if you want to live with that, I'll support you in that. If you're good with being who you are, that every day you wake up and every day you smell like shit because you can't wash your body well, and your skin's messed up because your health's so bad, and you can't put your clothes on right, you need help with that. You need help, like when I was doing, I need help wiping my ass. That makes you feel good? Nothing I can say to you. If every day you wake up with this, see, people are haunted, but they obviously like horror films because they keep watching the same fucking movie. I don't like horror films. A lot of people like horror films. So I don't say much to them. I say exactly what I said to you right there, because I was once you. I didn't like horror films, so I changed it. Some people are just, they become, like you said, it gets real small when you're lazy and you're fat. Your will, their will is so small that they don't have any and you can't give it to them. There has to be something. This is what I'm talking about now, because this isn't a hack. This has to be in you. Something in you has to wake up. And usually the only person that can wake it up is you. Sometimes you can read a David Goggins book, because I was all this shit and then a lot more of fucked up. But if you don't have a little flame, you know, just that, just barely, you're done. I can't light it for you. And that's the harsh reality of this life that I want to get across so fucking bad. You can watch me, you can watch you, you can watch fucking Rogan and Cameron Haynes, all these, you can go to Tony Robbins' fucking bullshit, all this shit. Do all this. If you could keep going back and keep spending money and spending money and spending money with no results, you can wonder, wow, maybe let me go try out David Goggins. He ain't going to fucking help you. You have to examine the insides of yourself. And what do you really want out of life? Your friend and a lot of people out here just don't fucking want it. So guess what? Have fun with your life. Go from 3 to 350 to 400 to 450 to 500. Because you don't want it. And that's the harsh reality. I can't give you shit. You can't give them shit. We can give you ideas. But in the day, when I was losing the weight, I had to miserably wake up every morning in the cold, because it was Indiana, November when it started. I was miserable. This is your new life. Take it or leave it. There's no happiness about it. There's no peace behind it. It sucks. It just sucks. And that's the one thing, if I could teach anybody anything, it just fucking sucks. And it's going to continue to suck. And then one day you'll get to a special part in your life that it might get a little bit better. But to lose the weight you have to lose, my friend, sorry. It's going to suck every day. Because then when you're 300 pounds, you're going to go out to lose weight. You could probably get injured. So then you got to work on the injury. And then you get even more depressed. This is what I went through. And then you're hungry because now you're depressed. It's just a vicious cycle. And if you're not strong mentally and you have no willpower, you're going to continue falling back in this hole versus the man that sits back and goes, all right, this is why I cuss, because this is what is in me. This is what it took for me to be me. Sorry. It didn't take, hey, okay, we're going to do this today. No, this thing really sucks. This is real, dude. This is real. And every day, I'm set back. So this is what I would tell your boy. This is exactly what I tell him. Every day you wake up, you're going to probably be set back for the first 4 weeks before you lose to significant weight, because of the mind is going to be fucking with you the whole time. There's no dopamine. There's no dopamine in there at 300 pounds. You got nothing. Your hormones are shot. You have to envision something that is more powerful than you. Something has to get you out of bed, and you have to create it. It has to be false, because you're not it. You're a fat piece of shit, and that's the reality of it. So you have to create a false reality to live in that, just to get to work on yourself. That's the reality. In pararescue training, water confidence is part of the 10-week program, and it's filled with specific evolutions designed to test how well we perform in the water under stress. One of the worst evolutions for me was called bobbing. The class was divided into groups of five, lined up from gutter to gutter in the shallow end, and fully kitted up. Our backs were strapped with twin 80s made from galvanized steel, and we wore 16-pound weight belts too. We were loaded the f*** down, which would have been fine, except in this evolution, we weren't allowed to breathe from those tanks. Instead, we were told to walk backward down the slope of the pool from the 3-foot section to the deep end, about 10 feet down, and on that slow walk into position, my mind swirled with doubt and negativity. What the f*** are you doing here? This isn't for you. You can't swim. You're an imposter, and they will find you out. Time slowed down, and those seconds seemed like minutes. My diaphragm lurched, trying to force air into my lungs. Theoretically, I knew that relaxation was the key to all the underwater evolutions, but I was too terrified to let go. My jaw clenched as tight as my fists. My head throbbed as I worked to stave off panic. Finally, we were all in position, and it was time to start bobbing. That meant pushing up from the bottom to the surface without the benefit of finning, getting a gulp of air, and sinking back down. It wasn't easy getting up fully loaded, but at least I was able to breathe. And that first breath was a salvation. Oxygen flooded my system, and I started to relax until the instructor yelled, "Switch." That was our cue to take our fins from our feet, place them on our hands, and use one pull with our arms to propel ourselves to the surface. We were allowed to push off the floor of the pool, but we couldn't kick. We did that for 5 minutes. Shallow water and surface blackouts aren't uncommon during water confidence training. It goes along with stressing the body and limiting oxygen intake. With the flippers on my hands, I'd barely get my face high enough out of the water to breathe. And in between, I was working hard and burning oxygen. And when you burn too much too fast, your brain shuts down and you will black the f*** out. Our instructors called that meeting the wizard. As the clock ticked, I could see stars materializing in my peripheral vision and felt the wizard creeping close. I passed that evolution, and soon, finning with my arms or feet became easy for me. What stayed hard from beginning to end was one of our simplest tasks, reading water without our hands. We had to keep our hands and our chins high above the water, using only our legs, which we'd swirl in a blender-like motion for 3 minutes. That doesn't sound like much time. And for most of the class, it was easy. For me, it was damn near impossible. My chin kept hitting the water, which meant the time would start again from 000. All around me, my classmates were so comfortable, their legs were barely moving, while mine were whirring at top speed. And I still couldn't get half as high as those white boys who looked to be defying gravity. Every day, it was another humiliation in the pool. Not that I was embarrassed publicly. I passed all the evolutions, but inside, I was suffering. Each night, I'd fixate on the next day's task and become so terrified I couldn't sleep. And soon my fear morphed into resentment toward my classmates, who, in my mind, had it easy, which dredged up my past. I was the only black man in my unit, which reminded me of my childhood in rural Indiana, and the harder the water confidence training became, the higher those dark waters would rise until it seemed I was also being drowned from the inside out. While the rest of my class was sleeping, that potent cocktail of fear and rage thrummed through my veins, and my nocturnal fixations became their own kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. One where failure was inevitable because my unchecked fear was unleashing something I couldn't control, the quitting mind. It all came to a head 6 weeks into training with the buddy breathing exercise. We partnered up, each pair gripped one another by the forearm, and took turns breathing through just one snorkel. Meanwhile, the instructors thrashed us, trying to separate us from our snorkel. All of this was supposed to be happening at or near the surface, but I was negatively buoyant, which meant I was sinking into the middle waters of the deep end, dragging my partner down with me. He'd take a breath and pass the snorkel down to me. I'd swim to the surface, exhale, and attempt to clear the water from our snorkel and get a clean breath before passing it back to him. But the instructors made that almost impossible. I'd usually only clear the tube halfway and inhale more water than air. From the jump, I was operating from an oxygen deficit, while fighting to stay near the surface. In military training, it's the instructor's job to identify weak links and challenge them to perform or quit. And they could tell I was struggling. In the pool that day, one of them was always in my face, yelling and thrashing me while I choked, trying and failing to gulp air through a narrow tube to stave off the wizard. I went under and remember looking up at the rest of the class, splayed out like serene starfish on the surface. Calm as can be, they passed their snorkels back and forth with ease while I fumed. I know now that my instructor was just doing his job, but back then I thought, this fucker's not giving me a fair shot. I passed that evolution too, but I still had 11 more evolutions and 4 more weeks of water confidence training to go. It made sense. We would be jumping out of airplanes over water. We needed it. I just didn't want to do it anymore. And the next morning, I was offered a way out I hadn't seen coming. Weeks earlier, we'd had our blood drawn during a med check, and the doctors discovered I carried the sickle cell trait. I didn't have the disease, sickle cell anemia, but I had the trait, which was believed at the time to increase the risk of sudden exercise-related death due to cardiac arrest. The Air Force didn't want me dropping dead in the middle of an evolution and pulled me out of training on the medical. I pretended to take the news hard, as if my dream was being ripped away. I made a big fucking act of being pissed off, but inside I was ecstatic. Later that week, the doctors reversed their decision. They didn't specifically say it was safe for me to continue, but they said the trait wasn't yet well understood and allowed me to decide for myself. When I reported back to training, the master sergeant informed me that I'd missed too much time and that if I wanted to continue, I would have to start over from day one, week one. Instead of less than 4 weeks, I'd have to endure another 10 weeks of the terror, rage, and insomnia that came with water confidence. These days, that kind of thing wouldn't even register on my radar. You tell me to run longer and harder than everyone else just to get a fair shake, I'd say, roger that and keep moving. But back then, I was still half-baked. Physically, I was strong, but I was not even close to mastering my mind. The master sergeant stared at me, awaiting my response. I couldn't even look him in the eye when I said, "You know what, Master Sergeant, the doctor doesn't know much about this sickle cell thing, and it's bothering me." He nodded, emotionless, and signed the papers pulling me out of the program for good. He cited sickle cell, and on paper, I didn't quit, but I knew the truth. If I had been the guy I am today, I wouldn't have given two about sickle cell. I still have the sickle cell trait. You don't just get rid of it. But back then, an obstacle had appeared, and I'd folded. I moved on to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, told my friends and family that I was forced from the program on a medical, and served out my 4 years in the Tactical Air Control Party, which works with some special operations units. I trained to liaise between ground units and air support, fast movers like F-15s and F-16s, behind enemy lines. It was challenging work with intelligent people, but sadly, I was never proud of it and didn't see the opportunities offered because I knew I was a quitter who had let fear dictate my future. I buried my shame in the gym and at the kitchen table. I got into powerlifting and layered on the mass. I ate and worked out and ate. In my last days in the Air Force, I weighed 255 pounds. After my discharge, I continued to bulk up with both muscle and fat until I weighed nearly 300 pounds. I wanted to be big because being big hit David Goggins. I was able to tuck this 175-pound person into those 21-inch biceps and that flabby belly. I grew a burly mustache and was intimidating to everyone who saw me. But inside, I knew I was a pussy, and that's a haunting feeling. The morning I began to take charge of my destiny started out like any other. When the clock struck 7 a.m., my Echolab shift ended, and I hit the Steak and Shake drive-thru to score a large chocolate milkshake. Next stop, 7-Eleven, for a box of Hostess mini chocolate donuts. I gobbled those on my 45-minute drive home to a beautiful apartment on a golf course in pretty Carmel, Indiana, which I share with my wife, Pam, and her daughter. We couldn't afford that life. Pam wasn't even working, but in those credit card debt-loading days, nothing made much sense. I was doing 70M on the highway, mainlining sugar and listening to a local classic rock station when the sound of silence poured from the stereo. Simon E. Garfunkel's words echoed like truth. Darkness was a friend indeed. I worked in the dark, hid my true self from friends and strangers. Nobody would have believed how numb and afraid I was back then because I looked like a beast that no one would dare f*** with. But my mind wasn't right, and my soul was weighed down by too much trauma and failure. I had every excuse in the world to be a loser and used them all. My life was crumbling, and Pam dealt with that by fleeing the scene. Her parents still lived in Brazil, just 70 miles away. We spent most of our time apart. I arrived home from work around 8 a.m., and the phone rang as soon as I walked in the door. It was my mother. She knew my routine. "Come on over for your staple," she said. My staple was a breakfast buffet for one, the likes of which few could put down in a single sitting. Think 8 Pillsbury cinnamon rolls, a half dozen scrambled eggs, a half pound of bacon, and 2 bowls of Fruity Pebbles. Don't forget, I had just decimated a box of donuts and a chocolate shake. I didn't even have to respond. She knew I was coming. Food was my drug of choice, and I always sucked up every last crumb. I hung up, flipped on the television, and stomped down the hall to the shower, where I could hear a narrator's voice filter through the steam. Navy SEALs, toughest the world. I wrapped a towel around my waist and rushed back into the living room. I was so big, the towel barely covered my fat ass, but I sat down on the couch and didn't move for 30 minutes. The show followed basic underwater demolition SEAL, training class 224 through Hell Week, the most arduous series of tasks and the most physically demanding training in the military. I watched men sweat and suffer as they tore through muddy obstacle courses, ran on the soft sand holding logs overhead and shivered in icy surf. Sweat pearled on my scalp. I was literally on the edge of my seat as I saw guys, some of the strongest of them all, ring the bell and quit. Made sense. Only 1/3 of the men who begin BUDS make it through Hell Week, and in all of my time in pararescue training, I couldn't remember feeling as awful as these men looked. They were swollen, chafed, sleep-deprived, and dead on their feet, and I was jealous of them. The longer I watched, the more certain I became that there were answers buried in all that suffering, answers that I needed. More than once, the camera panned over the endless frothing ocean, and each time I felt pathetic. The SEALs were everything I wasn't. They were about pride, dignity, and the type of excellence that came from bathing in the fire, getting beat up and going back for more. Again and again, they were the human equivalent of the hardest, sharpest sword you could imagine. They sought out the flame, took the pounding for as long as necessary, longer even, until they were fearless and deadly. They weren't motivated. They were driven. The show ended with graduation. 22 proud men stood shoulder to shoulder in their dress whites before the camera pushed in on their commanding officer. In a society where mediocrity is too often the standard and too often rewarded, he said, "There is intense fascination with men who detest mediocrity, who refuse to define themselves in conventional terms, and who seek to transcend traditionally recognized human capabilities. This is exactly the type of person BUDS is meant to find. The man who finds a way to complete each and every task to the best of his ability. The man who will adapt and overcome any and all obstacles." In that moment, it felt as though the commanding officer was talking directly to me. But after the show ended, I walked back to the bathroom, faced the mirror, and stared myself down. I looked every bit of 300 pounds. I was everything all the haters back home said I would be. Uneducated with no real-world skills, zero discipline, and a dead-end future. Mediocrity would have been a major promotion. I was at the bottom of the barrel of life, pooling in the dregs, but for the first time in way too long, I was awake. I barely spoke to my mother during breakfast and only ate half my staple because my mind was on unfinished business. I'd always wanted to join an elite special operations unit, and beneath all the rolls of flesh and layers of failure, that desire was still there. Now, it was coming back to life, thanks to a chance viewing of a show that continued to work on me like a virus moving cell to cell, taking over. It became an obsession I couldn't shake. Every morning after work for almost 3 weeks, I called active duty recruiters in the Navy and told them my story. I called offices all over the country. I said I was willing to move as long as they could get me to SEAL training. Everyone turned me down. Most weren't interested in candidates with prior service. One local recruiting office was intrigued and wanted to meet in person. But when I got there, they laughed in my face. I was way too heavy, and in their eyes, I was just another delusional pretender. I left that meeting feeling the same way. After calling all the active duty recruiting offices I could find, I dialed the local unit of the Naval Reserves and spoke to Petty Officer Steven Shaljo for the first time. Shaljo had worked with multiple F-14 squadrons as an electrician and instructor at NAS Miramar for 8 years before joining the recruitment staff in San Diego, where the SEALs trained. He worked day and night and rose quickly in the ranks. His move to Indianapolis came with a promotion and the challenge of finding Navy recruits in the middle of the corn. He'd only been on the job in Indy for 10 days by the time I called. And if I'd reached anyone else, you probably wouldn't be reading this book. But through a combination of dumb luck and stubborn persistence, I found one of the finest recruiters in the Navy, a guy whose favorite task was discovering diamonds in the rough. Prior service guys like me who were looking to re-enlist and hoping to land in special operations. Our initial conversation didn't last long. He said he could help me and that I should come in to meet in person. That sounded familiar. I grabbed my keys and drove straight to his office, but didn't get my hopes too high. By the time I arrived a half hour later, he was already on the phone with Bud's administration. Every sailor in that office, all of them white, were surprised to see me, except Shaljo. If I was a heavyweight, Shaljo was a lightweight at 5'7", but he didn't seem fazed by my size, at least not at first. He was outgoing and warm like any salesman, though I could tell he had some pit bull in him. He led me down a hall to weigh me in, and while standing on the scale, I eyed a weight chart pinned to the wall. At my height, the maximum allowable weight for the Navy was 191 pounds. I held my breath, sucked in my gut as much as I could, and puffed out my chest in a sorry attempt to stave off the humiliating moment where he'd let me down easy. That moment never came. "You're a big boy," Shaljo said, smiling and shaking his head as he scratched 297 pounds on a chart in his file folder. The Navy has a program that allows recruits in the reserves to become active duty. That's what we'll use for this. It's being phased out at the end of the year, so we need to get you classed up before then. Point is, you have some work to do, but you knew that. I followed his eyes to the weight chart and checked it again. He nodded, smiled, patted me on the shoulder, and left me to face my truth. I had less than 3 months to lose 106 pounds. It sounded like an impossible task, which is one reason I didn't quit my job. The other was the ASVAB. That nightmare test had come back to life like Frankenstein's fucking monster. I'd passed it once before to enlist in the Air Force, but to qualify for BUDS, I'd have to score much higher. For 2 weeks, I studied all day and zapped pests each night. I wasn't working out yet. Serious weight loss would have to wait. I took the test on a Saturday afternoon. The following Monday, I called Shaljo. "Welcome to the Navy," he said. He downloaded the good news first. I'd done exceptionally well on some sections and was now officially a reservist, but I'd only scored a 44 on mechanical comprehension. To qualify for BUDS, I needed a 50. I'd have to retake the entire test in 5 weeks. These days, Steven Shaljo likes to call our chance connection fate. He said he could sense my drive the first moment we spoke and that he believed in me from the jump, which is why my weight wasn't an issue for him. But after that ASVAB test, I was full of doubt. So maybe what happened later that night was also a form of fate or a much needed dose of divine intervention. I'm not going to drop the name of the restaurant where it went down, because if I did, you'd never eat there again and I'd have to hire a lawyer. Just know, this place was a disaster. I checked the traps outside first and found a dead rat. Inside, there were more dead rodents, a mouse and two rats, on the sticky traps, and roaches in the garbage, which hadn't been emptied. I shook my head, got down on my knees under the sink, and sprayed up through a narrow gap in the wall. I didn't know it yet, but I'd found their nesting column, and when the poison hit, they started to scatter. Within seconds, there was a skittering across the back of my neck. I brushed it off and craned my neck to see a storm of roaches rain down to the kitchen floor from an open panel in the ceiling. I'd hit the motherload of cockroaches and the worst infestation I ever saw on the job for Ecolab. They kept coming. Roaches landed on my shoulders and my head. The floor was writhing with them. I left my canister in the kitchen, grabbed the sticky traps, and burst outside. I needed fresh air and more time to figure out how I was going to clear the restaurant of vermin. I considered my options on my way to the dumpster to trash the rodents, opened the lid, and found a live raccoon hissing mad. He bared his yellow teeth and lunged at me. I slammed the dumpster shut. What the f***? I mean, seriously, what the f***? When was enough truly going to be enough? Was I willing to let my sorry present become a f***ed up future? How much longer would I wait? How many more years would I burn? Wondering if there was some greater purpose out there waiting for me. I knew right then that if I didn't make a stand and start walking the path of most resistance, I would end up in this mental hell forever. I didn't go back inside that restaurant. I didn't collect my gear. I started my truck, stopped for a chocolate shake, my comfort tea at that time, and drove home. It was still dark when I pulled up. I didn't care. I stripped off my work clothes, put on some sweats, and laced up my running shoes. I hadn't run in over a year, but I hit the streets ready to go 4 miles. I lasted 400 yards. My heart raced. I was so dizzy I had to sit down on the edge of the golf course to catch my breath before making the slow walk back to my house, where my melted shake was waiting to comfort me in yet another failure. I grabbed it, slurped, and slumped into my sofa. My eyes welled with tears. Who the f*** did I think I was? I was born nothing. I'd proven nothing, and I still wasn't worth a damn thing. David Goggins, a Navy SEAL. Yeah, right. What a pipe dream. I couldn't even run down the block for 5 minutes. All my fears and insecurities I'd bottled up for my entire life started raining down my head. I was on the verge of giving in and giving up for good. That's when I found my old beat to this copy of Rocky, the one I'd had for 15 years, slid it into the machine, and fast-forwarded to my favorite scene, round 14. The original Rocky is still one of my all-time favorite films because it's about a no-nothing journeyman fighter living in poverty with no prospects. Even his own trainer won't work with him. Then, out of the blue, he's given a title shot with the champion, Apollo Creed, the most feared fighter in history, a man that has knocked out every opponent he's ever faced. All Rocky wants is to be the first to go the distance with Creed. That alone will make him someone he could be proud of for the first time in his life. The fight is closer than anyone anticipated, bloody and intense. And by the middle rounds, Rocky is taking on more and more punishment. He's losing the fight. And in round 14, he gets knocked down early, but pops right back up in the center of the ring. Apollo moves in, stalking him like a lion. He throws sharp left jabs, hits a slow-footed Rocky with a staggering combination, lands a punishing right hook and another. He backs Rocky into a corner. Rocky's legs are jelly. He can't even muster the strength to raise his arms in defense. Apollo slams another right hook into the side of Rocky's head, then a left hook and a vicious right-handed uppercut that puts Rocky down. Apollo retreats to the opposite corner with his arms held high. But even face down in that ring, Rocky doesn't give up. As the referee begins his 10 count, Rocky squirms toward the ropes. Mickey, his own trainer, urges him to stay down, but Rocky isn't hearing it. He pulls himself up to one knee, then all fours. The referee hits six as Rocky grabs the ropes and rises up. The crowd roars, and Apollo turns to see him still standing. Rocky waves Apollo over. The champ's shoulders slump in disbelief. The fight isn't over yet. I turned off the television and thought about my own life. It was a life devoid of any drive and passion, But I knew if I continued to surrender to my fear and my feelings of inadequacy, I would be allowing them to dictate my future forever. My only other choice was to try to find the power in the emotions that had laid me low, harness.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
And use them to empower me to rise up, which is exactly what I did. I dumped that shake in the trash, laced up my shoes, and hit the streets again. On my first run, I felt severe pain in my legs and my lungs at a quarter mile. My heart raced and I stopped. This time I felt the same pain. My heart raced like a car running hot, but I ran through it and the pain faded. By the time I bent over to catch my breath, I'd run a full mile. That's when I first realized that not all physical and mental limitations are real, and that I had a habit of giving up way too soon. I also knew that it would take every ounce of courage and toughness I could muster to pull off the impossible. I was staring at hours, days, and weeks of nonstop suffering. I would have to push myself to the very edge of my mortality. I had to accept the very real possibility that I might die, because this time I wouldn't quit, no matter how fast my heart raced and no matter how much pain I was in. Trouble was, there was no battle plan to follow, no blueprint. I had to create one from scratch. The typical day went something like this. I wake up at 4:30 a.m., munch a banana, and hit the ASVAB books. Around 5 a.m., I'd take that book to my stationary bike where I'd sweat and study for 2 hours. Remember, my body was a mess. I couldn't run multiple miles yet, so I had to burn as many calories as I could on the bike. After that, I'd drive over to Carmel High School and jump into the pool for a 2-hour swim. From there, I hit the gym for a circuit workout that included the bench press, the incline press, and lots of leg exercises. Bulk was the enemy. I needed reps, and I did 5 or 6 sets of 100 reps each. Then it was back to the stationary bike for 2 more hours. I was constantly hungry. Dinner was my one true meal each day, but there wasn't much to it. I ate a grilled or sauteed chicken breast and some sauteed vegetables along with a thimble of rice. After dinner, I'd do another 2 hours on the bike, hit the sack, wake up and do it all over again, knowing the odds were stacked sky high against me. What I was trying to achieve is like a D student applying to Harvard or walking into a casino and putting every single dollar you own on a number in roulette and acting as if winning is a foregone conclusion. I was betting everything I had on myself with no guarantees. I weighed myself twice daily, and within 2 weeks, I dropped 25 pounds. My progress only improved as I kept grinding, and the weight started peeling off. 10 days later, I was at 250, light enough to begin doing push-ups, pull-ups, and to start running my ass off. I'd still wake up, hit the stationary bike, the pool, and the gym, but I also incorporated 2, 3, and 4 mile runs. I ditched my running shoes and ordered a pair of Baitslides, the same boot seal candidates wearing Buttas, and started running in those. With so much effort, you'd think my nights would have been restful, but they were filled with anxiety. My stomach growled and my mind swirled. I'd dream of complex ASVAB questions and dread the next day's workouts. I was putting out so much on almost no fuel that depression became a natural side effect. My splintering marriage was veering toward divorce. Palm made it very clear that she and my stepdaughter would not be moving to San Diego with me if by some miracle I could pull this off. They stayed in Brazil most of the time, and when I was all alone in Carmel, I was in turmoil. I felt both worthless and helpless, and my endless stream of self-defeating thoughts picked up steam. When depression smothers you, it blots out all light and leaves you with nothing to cling onto for hope. All you see is negativity. For me, the only way to make it through that was to feed off my depression. I had to flip it and convince myself that all that self-doubt and anxiety was confirmation that I was no longer living an aimless life. My task may turn out to be impossible, but at least I was back on a mission. Some nights, when I was feeling low, I'd call Shaljo. He was always in the office early in the morning and late at night. I didn't confide in him about my depression because I didn't want him to doubt me. I used those calls to pump myself up. I told him how many pounds I dropped and how much work I was putting in, and he reminded me to keep studying for that ASVAB. Roger that. I had the Rocky soundtrack on cassette, and I listened to Going the Distance for inspiration. On long bike rides and runs, with those horns blasting in my brain, I'd imagine myself going through Bud, diving into cold water, and crushing Hell Week. I was wishing, I was hoping, but by the time I was down to 250, my quest to qualify for the SEALs wasn't a daydream anymore. I had a real chance to accomplish something most people, including myself, thought was impossible. Still, there were bad days. One morning, not long after I dipped below 250, I weighed in and had only lost a pound from the day before. I had so much weight to lose, I could not afford to plateau. That's all I thought about while running 6 miles and swimming too. I was exhausted and sore when I arrived in the gym for my typical 3-hour circuit. After rocking over 100 pull-ups in a series of sets, I was back on the bar for a max set with no ceiling. Going in, my goal was to get to 12, but my hands were burning fire as I stretched my chin over the bar for the 10th time. For weeks, the temptation to pull back had been ever present, and I always refused. That day, however, the pain was too much, and after my 11th pull-up, I gave in, dropped down, and finished my workout, one pull-up shy. That one rep stayed with me, along with that 1 pound. I tried to get them out of my head, but they wouldn't leave me the fuck alone. They taunted me on the drive home and at my kitchen table while I ate a sliver of grilled chicken and a bland baked potato. I knew I wouldn't sleep that night unless I did something about it, so I grabbed my keys. You cut corners and you are not gonna fucking make it, I said out loud as I drove back to the gym. There are no shortcuts for you, Goggins. I did my entire pull-up workout over again. One missed pull-up cost me an extra 250, and there would be similar episodes. Whenever I cut a run or swim short because I was hungry or tired, I'd always go back and beat myself down even harder. That was the only way I could manage the demons in my mind. Either way, there would be suffering. I had to choose between physical suffering in the moment and the mental anguish of wondering if that one missed pull-up, that last lap in the pool, the quarter mile I skipped on the road or trail would end up costing me an opportunity of a lifetime. It was an easy choice. When it came to the SEALs, I wasn't leaving anything up to chance. On the eve of the ASVAB, with 4 weeks to go before training, making weight was no longer a worry. I was already down to 215 pounds and was faster and stronger than I'd ever been. I was running 6 miles a day, bicycling over 20 miles, and swimming more than two. All of it in the dead of winter. My favorite run was the 6-mile Monon Trail, an asphalt bike and walking path that lays through the trees in Indianapolis. It was the domain of cyclists and soccer moms with jogging strollers, weekend warriors, and seniors. By then, Shaljo had passed along the Navy SEAL warning order. It included all the workouts I would be expected to complete during first phase of buddies, and I was happy to double them. I knew that 190 men usually class up for a typical SEAL training, and only about 40 people make it all the way through. I didn't want to be just one of those 40. I wanted to be the best, but I had to pass the damn ASVAB first. I'd been cramming every spare second. If I wasn't working out, I was at my kitchen table memorizing formulas and cycling through hundreds of vocabulary words. With my physical training going well, all my anxiety stuck to the ASVAB like paper clips to a magnet. This would be my last chance to take the test before my eligibility for the SEALs expired. I wasn't very smart, and based on past academic performance, there was no good reason to believe I'd pass with a score high enough to qualify for the SEALs. If I failed, my dream would die, and I'd be floating without purpose once again. The test was held in a small classroom on Fort Benjamin Harrison in Indianapolis. There were about 30 people there, all of us young. Most were just out of high school. we were each assigned an old school desktop computer. In the past month, the tests had been digitized and I wasn't experienced with computers. I didn't even think I could work the damn machine, let alone answer the questions, but the program proved idiot-proof and I settled in. The ASVAB has 10 sections and I was breezing through until I reached mechanical comprehension, my true serum. Within the hour, I would have a decent idea if I'd been lying to myself or if I had the raw stuff necessary to become a SEAL. Whenever a question stumped me, I marked my worksheet with a dash. There were about 30 questions in that section, and by the time I completed the test, I guessed at least 10 times. I needed some of them to go my way or I was out. After completing the final section, I was prompted to send the entire bundle to the administrator's computer at the front of the room where the score would be tabulated instantly. I peeked over my monitor and saw him sitting there, waiting. I pointed, clicked, and left the room. Buzzing with nervous energy, I paced the parking lot for a few minutes before finally ducking into my Honda Accord, but I didn't start the engine. I couldn't leave. I sat in the front seat for 15 minutes with a 1,000-yard stare. It would be at least 2 days before Xiaojo would call with my results. But the answer to the riddle that was my future was already solved. I knew exactly where it was, and I had to know the truth. I gathered myself, walked back in, and approached the fortune teller. "You gotta tell me what I got on this f***ing test, man," I said. He peered up at me, surprised, but he didn't buckle. "I'm sorry, son. This is the government. There's a system for how they do things," he said. "I didn't make the rules, and I can't bend them." "Sir, you have no idea what this test means to me, to my life. It's everything." He looked into my glassy eyes for what felt like 5 minutes, then turned toward his machine. "I'm breaking every rule in the book right now," he said. "Goggins, right?" I nodded and came around behind his seat as he scrolled through files. "There you are. Congratulations, you scored 65. That's a great score." He was referencing my overall, but I didn't care about that. Everything hinged on my getting a 50 spot where it counted most. "What did I get on mechanical comprehension?" he shrugged, clicked and scrolled, and there it was. My new favorite number glowed on his screen. 50. "Yes!" I shouted. "Yes! Yes!" There was still a handful of others taking the test, but this was the happiest moment in my life and I couldn't stifle it. I kept screaming yes at the top of my lungs. The administrator damn near fell out of his chair and everyone in that room stared at me like I was crazy. If they only knew how crazed I'd been. For 2 months, I dedicated my entire existence to this one moment and I was damn well going to enjoy it. I rushed to my car and screamed some more. On my drive home, I called my mom. She was the one person, aside from Xiaojo, who witnessed my metamorphosis. "I did it," I told her, tears in my eyes. "I did it. I'm going to be a SEAL." When Xiaojo came to work the next day, he got the news and called me up. He sent in my recruitment package and had just heard back that I was in. I could tell he was happy for me and proud that what he saw in me the first time we met turned out to be real. But it wasn't all happy days. My wife had given me an implied ultimatum, and now I had a decision to make. Abandon the opportunity I'd worked so hard for and stay married, or get divorced and go try to become a SEAL. In the end, my choice didn't have anything to do with my feelings for Pam or her father. He'd apologized to me, by the way. It was about who I was and who I wanted to be. I was a prisoner in my own mind, and this opportunity was my only chance to break free. I celebrated my victory the way any SEAL candidate should. I put the out. The following morning, and for the next 3 weeks, I spent time in the pool, strapped with a 16-pound weight belt. I swam underwater for 50 meters at a time and walked the length of the pool underwater with a brick in each hand, all on a single breath. The water would not own my ass this time. When I was done, I'd swim a mile or two, then head to a pond near my mother's home. Remember, this was Indiana, the American Midwest, in December. The trees were naked. Icicles hung like crystals from the eaves of houses and snow blanketed the earth in all directions. But the pond wasn't completely frozen yet. I waded into the icy water dressed in camo pants, a brown short-sleeved shirt, and boots, laid back and looked into the gray sky. The hypothermic water washed over me. The pain was excruciating, and I loved it. After a few minutes, I got out and started running, water sloshing in my boots, sand in my underwear. Within seconds, my t-shirt was frozen to my chest, my pants iced at the cuffs. I hit the Manan Trail. Steam poured from my nose and mouth as I grunted and slalomed speedwalkers and joggers. Civilians. Their heads turned as I picked up speed and began sprinting, like Rocky in downtown Philly. I ran as fast as I could for as long as I could, from a past that no longer defined me, toward a future undetermined. All I knew was that there would be pain and there would be purpose, and that I was ready. The first step on the journey toward a calloused mind is stepping outside your comfort zone on a regular basis. Dig out your journal again and write down all the things you don't like to do or that make you uncomfortable, especially those things you know are good for you. Now go do one of them and do it again. This is not about changing your life instantly. It's about moving the needle bit by bit and making those changes sustainable. That means digging down to the micro level and doing something that sucks every day. Even if it's as simple as making your bed, doing the dishes, ironing your clothes, or getting up before dawn and running 2 miles each day. Once that becomes comfortable, take it to 5, then 10 miles. If you already do all those things, find something you aren't doing. We all have areas in our lives we either ignore or can improve upon. Find yours. We often choose to focus on our strengths rather than our weaknesses. Use this time to make your weaknesses your strengths. Doing things, even small things, that make you uncomfortable will help make you strong. The more often you get uncomfortable, the stronger you'll become, and soon you'll develop a more productive, can-do dialogue with yourself in stressful situations. I realized that God wasn't going to give me a get-out-of-jail-free card. And from the time I was born into the time I was 19 years old, my life had these hurdles. I constantly hit obstacles, obstacle after obstacle after obstacle. And I had to figure out how to manage suffering, how to deal with it, because it'd be part of my life forever. At least that's what I thought. So in order to deal with it, I had to be able to conquer it and overcome it and deal with it and know that in this suffering, there has to be some kind of growth. With every obstacle, I look at it as friction now. Without friction, there is no growth. You have to have friction in your life to grow. So I start looking at all these different things versus the woe is me mentality. Like, oh my God, look at my life. My life's so, I come from this family. I'm being beaten. I'm being abused mentally, physically. I start looking at it as the perfect trial ground. So I had to flip it upside down. I said, okay, I'm suffering tremendously, mentally. Use this to your advantage versus your disadvantage. So that's what I did. Versus looking at it as like, oh my God, woe is me. I'm never going to get out of here. I looked at it as, okay, hang on a second. If I can overcome this, if I can find some power in this, some way to get through this, that right there will be the fuel for the rest of my life. And so I found great strength in suffering. Great strength in it, because why? Through all of that, it started to callous my mind over the victim's mentality. This whole thing about suffering, yeah, it sucks really bad. Really, really bad. But we all live on this side of suffering. On this side. This nice box that's very comfortable, that we know when everything is going to happen. We're in it. It's good. We know how everything's going to turn out. It's those few people who are willing to go on this side of suffering. And once they get through that, ask him how he feels now. His mind. How far he grew. In that short period of time, he grew so much more than the normal person, because he was willing to go outside himself. Because on the other end of suffering is greatness. It's not over here. So a whole bunch of us, we put ourselves in this great box. And in that box, there's no suffering in it. So what we do is we shelter ourselves from greatness. So for me, for instance, I was 300 damn pounds at one time in my life. Spray for cockroaches, made $1,000 a month. I was living in that box. I would sometimes look over the box and I saw hell, suffering, storms, avalanches, tornadoes. I don't want to go over there. But I knew if I can get through that mentally,
On the other side was a 185-pound person who's a Navy SEAL, went through Ranger School. Only person to do this. Only person to do that. Only person to do this. But that's through all of that. All that I have to go through. So you peek over the box and you go back in and say, oh, I'm okay being 300 pounds, making $1,000 a month. Right. I'm okay over here. And on the other side is where you start to really start your journey. People think they start their journey because they're born. No, there's a lot of people in graves who have lived 100 years and have never started their real journey. Your real journey starts when you go outside that box and you start climbing mountains and start climbing mountains. And you think you're at the top of the mountain, you go down the other side of it, you think, I'm here. And you look up, there's another mountain. And it goes on and it goes on and it goes on. And just when you're getting ready to quit, you crest that final mountain, you get down and you look. And there you are. And it starts to make sense to you then.
It's so easy to get lost in the fog of life. Tragedy hunts us all. And any event that causes suffering will linger longer than it should if you let it. Because our sad stories enable us to grade ourselves on a forgiving curve. They give us latitude and justification to stay lazy, weak-minded. And the longer it takes for us to process that pain, the harder it is to reclaim our lives. Sometimes, weakness and laziness are rooted in hate and anger. And until we receive the confession, apology, or compensation we believe we are owed, we stay stuck in our shit as a form of self-righteous rebellion against our tormentors or even against life itself. Some of us become entitled. We think our pain entitles us to feel sorry for ourselves or that we are entitled to good fortune because we survived hell. Of course, feeling entitled doesn't make it so. Understand? The clock is always ticking, and at some point, your golden hour will expire unless you take action. People who get lost in their past, the ones who bore their friends and family with the same tragic story over and over without showing a hint of progress, remind me of a skydiver who becomes too fixated on their tangled parachute. They know they have a backup ready to go, but burn so much time trying to fix the primary chute that they forget to track their altimeter. And by the time they cut the first chute away and pull the second ripcord, it's too late. Part of the problem is that they have become terrified of pulling that second cord, because if it's also f***ed up, then they truly will be helpless. That is a mental trap set by fear. We cannot afford to remain afraid of cutting away dead weight to save ourselves. I was that skydiver for far too long. My father was violent. My mom was broken. I was bullied, laughed at, and misunderstood. Check, check, and checkmate. And yet, I was breathing free, and I was not bleeding. Physically, I was alive and well, and perfectly capable of cutting all of that bullshit away. I'd wasted way too much of my life telling myself the same sad story. I needed to move forward. It was time to write something new. If an act of God or nature tore your life apart, the good news is that you really have nobody to blame. Yet, the randomness of it all can feel so personal, as if you've been marked for doom by the fates. If you feel wronged by somebody else, you may be waiting on a confession or an apology in order to move forward. But I'm sorry to say the apology, that tearful confession you've been dreaming of, will never come. The good news is you don't need anybody else to free you from your trauma. You can do it on your own. My father never apologized to me. Nobody ever said sorry for anything I went through. I had to come to the conclusion that while I didn't deserve any of it, I was my main problem and primary obstacle. I'd given Trunis Goggins all my power. I had to take it back. I had to defuse my demon. I had to shrink him down to the lowly, pathetic figure he was by, humanizing him. Just as there was no other way to come out of the gauntlet that was my childhood except up, I had to see that he was a mortally f***ed up piece of shit because of what he went through. Once I understood that, it was up to me to either do the hard work to break that cycle or stay cursed. Like medics on the scene of a car accident, we all must act with a sense of urgency and tune into that ticking clock in the back of our minds. Because there is a drop dead time on everything we do in life. All our dreams and visions come with expiration dates etched in invisible ink. Windows of opportunity can and do close, So it is imperative that we do not waste time on bull. None of us have any clue what's coming for us or when our time might run out, which is why I do my best to ignore anything that is counterproductive. I'm not suggesting we act like robots, but we need to understand that forward motion gives our lives momentum. We need to remember that sometimes chaos will descend and a clear highway can be wiped out by a flash flood in the blink of an eye. When that happens, a lot of look for a cozy place to hunker down and hide out until the storm passes. I'm only human, they say. When holy hell rains down upon them and they feel drained and powerless, they cannot conceive of a way to keep going. I understand that impulse, but if I had succumbed to the I'm only human mentality, I never would have dug myself out of the deep hole I was in at 24 years old. Because the second you utter those words, the white towel is fluttering in the air and your mind stops looking for more fuel. I didn't know for sure if I'd ever find my way out of the darkness. I just knew that I could not throw in the towel, and neither can you, because there is no towel in our corner. There is only water and a cut man. And if those are your only options, you have no choice but to keep fighting until you overcome every last thing that once held you back. You have been preoccupied by bull for way too long. It's time to switch your focus to the things that will slingshot you forward.
For some reason, God put me in almost every f***ed up situation on the planet Earth. So when I talk to people, it's not sugarcoated, because I'm not saying it from I was 175 pounds my whole life. I don't say much to those people. Maybe you're a piece of shit. Maybe you want to be nobody. Maybe you're happy exactly where you are in life, because obviously you are. Maybe you don't have the determination to be somebody better than who you are. And if you want to live with that, I'll support you in that. If you're good with being who you are, that every day you wake up and every day you smell like shit because you can't wash your body well, and your skin's messed up because your health's so bad, and you can't put your clothes on right, you need help with that. You need help, like when I was 300 pounds, I need help wiping my ass. That makes you feel good? Nothing I can say to you. If every day you wake up with this, see, people are haunted, but they obviously like horror films because they keep watching the same movie. I don't like horror films. A lot of people like horror films. So I don't say much to them. I say exactly what I said to you right there, because I was once you. I didn't like horror films, so I changed it. Some people are just, they become, like you said, it gets real small when you're lazy and you're fat. Their will is so small that they don't have any and you can't give it to them. There has to be something. This is what I'm talking about now, because this isn't a hack. This has to be in you. Something in you has to wake up. And usually the only person that can wake it up is you. Sometimes you can read a David Goggins book, because I was all this and then a lot more fucked up. But if you don't have a little flame, you know, just that, just barely, you're done. I can't light it for you. You have to examine the insides of yourself. And what do you really want out of life?
When I first got into endurance events, I loved the breakdown phase because the suffering made me feel alive and reminded me that I'd gone all out. This time, I didn't relish it in the same way, but I knew that breakdown was a byproduct of an all-out effort, and that if I explored the crevices of my mind, I would find valuable lessons, which tend to spill out with any unraveling. Most people prefer to avoid breakdowns like this because the suffering can be so overwhelming, it just might mark you forever. I embrace breakdown and welcome the scarring. There is a hell of a lot of information in scar tissue. Scars are proof that the past is real. Physical scars never go away. And when you look at them, they can bring you right back to a specific place in time. But the scar tissue that builds up around that old injury is weak. Professional fighters who've been hit in the face thousands of times bleed faster than those who have never been punched. Once you've been cut deep, you are forever vulnerable to bleeding. The same is true for the mental and emotional scars that we all carry with us. Scars we cannot see. They might be invisible, but they affect us much more severely than physical scars. Mental and emotional scars are our weak spots, and they can open up just as easily as physical scars. unless we do the work to strengthen them. If you haven't dealt with your scars, they can alter your life's path. You will be prone to failure during difficult physical and emotional situations, whether that's during an athletic event, at work, or in your home life. And eventually, you will land back in front of your mirror that never lies. Breakdown is its own kind of mirror. Whatever you're made of is laid out in front of you clear and plain. Your history and mindset become a weathered old map ridged with your scars. And if you read them like an archaeologist on a dig, you might uncover the code you need to rise again and become better and stronger. Because there is no transformation without breakdown, and there is always another evolution, another skin to shed, a better or deeper version of ourselves waiting to be revealed.